Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Ones and Twos, FP's economics podcast. Every week, we take a couple data points, use them to try to explain the world. I'm Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor, with you in Berlin, Germany. As always, Adam Tooze, FP's economics columnist and Columbia University professor, is with us in Frankfurt. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Cam.
So we have one topic for you this week. That will be on the economics of Gaza and humanitarian aid in Gaza. But first, I wanted to share an exciting opportunity that's available for a select group of listeners in the DC area. Adam and I are hosting a live taping of Ones and Twos for foreign policy subscribers in the heart of Washington next week. This is a subscriber-only event, but we've reserved a number of tickets for loyal podcast listeners too. It's our small way of showing appreciation for your continued support and commitment to the conversations that we facilitate each week. And we hope you'll join us in D.C. The event is on Thursday, April 18th, at the historic John Hopkins Bloomberg Center, which is nestled right between the U.S. Capitol and the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. All you have to do is email us at podcasts@foreignpolicy.com to request information and tickets to this exclusive gathering. Don't wait too long. Only the first 50 listeners to email us will secure 2 complimentary tickets each. So email podcasts@foreignpolicy.com right now to get on the list. If you do not get on the list, don't fret either. There will be another live show that Adam and I are organizing in Washington, D.C. That will be in September, so a few months away. That will be at the historic 6th and I Synagogue. There'll be information on that sometime later. But point is, if you don't get on the list for next week's event, you can keep your ears perked for the event in September. As I mentioned, we will be talking about Gaza today, and the data point there is 50, as in 50%, as in half the population of Gaza, which is the share of the population on the brink of famine.
He warned the Biden administration that the spread of hunger and malnutrition in Gaza is, quote, unprecedented in modern history, and that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. This comes
the world court now ordering Israel to immediately allow food and water into Gaza.
Humanitarian agencies are calling for an immediate ceasefire and large deliveries of aid in Gaza, where a famine is looming. Israel insists it's less.
The entire population is said to be experiencing acute food insecurity and malnutrition, and that is a situation that still may get worse in the immediate future. Israel says that more aid trucks have been allowed into Gaza in recent days than at any other point since the fighting there started in October, but that fighting obviously is still ongoing, and some of it has claimed the lives of aid workers themselves, as we saw after the attack on a World Central Kitchen convoy last week in Gaza. It's been a while since we looked at the economy of Gaza on this show. It's an economy now that's pretty much defined by economic need, short-term need for humanitarian aid, long-term need for reconstruction assistance. It's an area that obviously has been completely devastated in multiple ways. So we thought we would take a closer look at the economics involved. Adam, I wanted to start by first off asking about famine, and specifically the economic effects, the long-term economic effects of even a short-term, or longer-term for that matter, experience of famine of the sort that we're seeing in Gaza right now.
I mean, it's such a grim subject. I mean, even before the October 7th events and the aftermath, 1.2 million of Gaza's 2 million people were estimated to be acutely food insecure, and over 80% were reliant on humanitarian aid. we are now tumbling towards an acute crisis. And I think it's important to distinguish between food insecurity, malnutrition, and outright famine. Right now, there are vulnerable people in Gaza dying of hunger. And that's an acute late stage phenomenon. It takes you weeks to get to the point where your bodily system actually shuts down. And the fact that any people at all are dying is a sign of an impending disaster, because for the most vulnerable to get to that point suggests that there is a large, if you like, slowly moving avalanche of people moving towards the precipice of disaster and death. Experienced aid workers who have seen this kind of process in action before are extremely alarmed. Estimates from early April suggested that somewhere close to 20% of children under the age of 5 were acutely malnourished, which was not a normal state of affairs. They were food insecure before, but they're now actually malnourished. Folks in northern Gaza, the most severely affected region, have been living effectively on about 245 calories a day. That's a can of beans, basically. Pregnant women in particular are extremely vulnerable, and elderly people. And we say this in part because of what we know, to actually try and answer your question about the impact of famine. And they're not easy to study, because famines often occur in conjunction with other disasters. That's, you know, famine is, as it were, the culmination of a more comprehensive crisis. So it's interesting to study politically induced famines, which bring about sudden shocks. So one is the Great Chinese Famine of the early 1960s, late 50s, early 60s. And another is the famine that hit the Netherlands in the final stages of World War II. People may not be aware of this, but the Allied advance after D-Day cut off a large part of the Netherlands, which was still under German occupation, and the German forces there did not secure the food supply of the local population. So it gives us a chance to actually study a famine in a population that was ordinarily reasonably well-nourished, and that suddenly, for exogenous reasons, this is what economists look for, suddenly experienced this shock. And the results of both these shock famine experiences, so in societies that were not previously massively stressed and suddenly go into crisis, is really quite unambiguous, which is that the food shock has a long-lasting impact on the population in terms of its physical, its mental health, its educational development, its human capital development. Folks who are exposed to these shocks tend to be shorter. They don't grow to the same natural stature of other people. And the impact, and the Dutch data is particularly clear-cut on this, is most severe in pregnant women in uterus. And it's estimated that there are 60,000 pregnant women in Gaza right now whose babies will be suffering nutritional shock. And it's really that group that is probably going to be most severely affected. On younger kids, actually, short-term famine exposure appears to produce a kind of hardiness, a physical hardiness. It's a tough thing to say, but it appears to be true, this on the basis of the Dutch evidence. But what it does do is very severe damage to their socioeconomic prospects going forward. So in the Dutch case, you saw long-lasting impacts on schooling and social development, presumably deriving from the mental health implications of sudden insecurity and existential risk. So one shouldn't, I think, underestimate the severity of this moment, even if food supply is ultimately restored. And that really, at this point, is still very much a best case, vain hope kind of scenario. The impact of this will be severe in the long term, and it will carry forward both as a biophysical shock to the body politic, literally, of the Palestinian population, as well, of course, as a political and psychosocial mental health shock. There will be hundreds of thousands of people suffering from very severe PTSD as a result of this experience.
Wow, yeah, that is hard to hear. And I think, as you've made clear, this is already now baked in to, I mean, even if there's a ceasefire now, these effects are predictable in the future.
Yeah. You don't get to the point when people are actually just flat out dying of starvation unless there is extremely serious malnutrition on a much larger scale going on, if you like, in the background.
So to turn to the physical destruction of Gaza and its economy and its infrastructure, obviously the devastation has been vast, but what kind of comparisons do we have historically for the extent of damage that we've already seen?
I mean, when you're looking at North Gaza, you're looking at one of the most intense bombardments in modern history. The estimates there are for damage in excess of 60 to 70% of the structures, and inflicted over a period of months, not years. And this means that the relevant standards of comparison are the kind of destruction seen in German cities under Allied bombing, extremely intense Allied bombing from 1942 onwards, which is really the first moment that modern aerial warfare became possible. The German bombing of London earlier in the war was a pinprick by comparison. And North Gaza, as far as we're able to tell, ranks alongside the likes of Dresden. In fact, the level of destruction in North Gaza seems to exceed that of Dresden, which was the victim, famously, of a ghastly firestorm. It's up there with Hamburg and Cologne and Berlin, some of the most heavily bombed cities. In the more recent past, you could look to the kind of urban warfare in the immediate region that was waged in the Syrian civil war, Aleppo, for instance, where 65% of the housing was damaged. North Gaza appears to have a level of destruction at least as high as those. So if you remember those images of Aleppo, which was like a city reduced to what looked like an ocean of rubble, we think in the case of North Gaza, we're talking about maybe 10 to 20 million tons worth of rubble that will ultimately need to be moved, really staggering numbers. And then the other two places that come to mind are the hugely material intensive campaign that was waged by the United States and its allies against ISIS, so the cities of Raqqa and Mosul, that were both subjected to extremely intense bombardment and where we saw similar levels of physical destruction and rather fewer civilian casualties, though they numbered in the thousands in both those cities, than we have seen in the Israeli assault into North Gaza and now the rest of the Gaza Strip. In other words, and I don't think there's really any doubt about this, that we are dealing with one of the most dramatic instances of what one group of analysts have called domicide. So when the British were planning the aerial bombardment of Germany in 1940, 41 and 42, before they were actually able to mobilize the air fleets that are necessary to do this on a large scale, they talked about dehousing the German population. And the phrase that is now apparently in circulation is domicide. So the deliberate destruction of the houses, the homes of an entire population. It's really an epic level of destruction. Early on in the war, we were making comparisons to Mariupol, but at least according to the data to my hands, and the level of destruction would seem to be roughly two times as intense. The data for the Mariupol are highly contested, I know, but the figure that I've found is a 32% destruction of structures there. North Gaza would appear to be about twice as intense as that.
Goodness. Yeah, I think as you just mentioned, you know, when this kind of strategy was imposed on Germany, this was at the very beginning of aerial warfare at all, right? Yeah. I mean, this was a kind of, you know, one could claim at that time that one didn't know strategically whether this was effective or not. I mean, I guess now we have this history to draw on in terms of saying what are the effects strategically, militarily, of this kind of warfare. So yeah, even if the kind of effects are the same, it seems to me strategically it must be different.
Well, I think in this case it really is, because this is, I mean, the strategic bombardment of Germany's cities was not, after all, in conjunction with tactical on-the-ground incursions. So the closest analogies really are to Mariupol and to Raqqa and the campaign against ISIS, because there you have a combined land and aerial operation. And the ability to coordinate strategic levels of destruction from the air and by artillery with a ground assault is a new kind of potency. Because you could do strategic bombing in World War II, but it took years to reduce a Berlin or a Cologne to the kind of level of destruction which has been inflicted on Gaza in a matter of months. So this is a measure both of the scale of the bombardment that we can now deliver, but also the relative levels of accuracy that are now available to military planners.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right here, but we will be back in a second to continue talking about Gaza.
Hi, ones and twos listeners. I'm Rob Sachs, one of the producers here at Foreign Policy. So here's a little secret I want to let you all in on. Almost all of our audio production is done from our laptops. Each day, our team is connecting with people from around the world, swapping audio files and scripts and everything we need to assemble the podcast you hear on Foreign Policy. Having secure and reliable data is our lifeblood. And I'm sure it is for many of you as well, which is why we're excited to tell you about CrashPlan. It's a service that offers unlimited computer backup for individuals and businesses at an affordable rate. It's quietly humming along in the background while you work encrypting and sending all your new or changed files up to their secure cloud every 15 minutes. So if anything should happen, it's no problem. Your backup is just a few clicks away. So for sound peace of mind, consider CrashPlan. And now you have the opportunity to support us when you do it. Go to crashplan.com/ones for 50% off your first year of CrashPlan. That's crashplan.com/ones for 50% off your first year.
Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. So now to turn to the economics of aid distribution itself. You know, I'm curious, how do aid workers, how do they manage an economy where there's really an absolute need for everything? I mean, where there otherwise is no economy to speak of. I mean, these are workers who have aid to deliver, but they have no authority or ability necessarily to impose an economic order the way a state could. So, you know, what is the economic logic at work in the distributional system that they are required to create?
It's a fascinating question. I went online to the Relief Web, you know, this site where they aggregate all of the different appeals for relief. And if you start looking at the daily flow of appeals for Gaza, what you see is a kind of functional structuring of the appeals. It isn't, you know, economics in the sense of, you know, X number of hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, which then are going to be rationally allocated between the following purposes. It seems to be driven much more directly simply by how do we keep people alive? And how do we empower other people to keep people alive? And I think that that is an important calculation. So at the top of most of the list do come the hospital facilities of Gaza itself, because by supporting them, you're supporting Gazans to support each other. So there seems to be a kind of important logic there of providing aid to those who provide aid. So that's one element of the story. Another element of the story then is a basic needs approach. So what the appeals focus on is food for the most vulnerable, the elderly, the ill, the pregnant, and the children. And then water, which will kill people even more quickly if you don't have clean water, enough of it, or uncontaminated water. And so that's what the demands seem to focus on, the appeals need to focus on, and the desperate, urgent work on the ground is focusing on is restoring water supply lines, because there's been a desperate shortage of water in recent weeks and months, and getting food in. An economics element enters in when you start asking, well, in a society like this, what is the price of water and food? Because things do have a price, even when they're as scarce as this, because after all, you can appropriate relief aid. And one figure I've seen is that a 25 kilo, so a 50-pound bag of flour, because this is a population that eats bread, a 25-kilo bag of flour, 50-pound bag of flour, goes for $1,000 in Gaza right now. And if that's the case, then another element enters the story here, which is protection. How do you ensure that these supplies, which are as desperately needed as this, are protected? And at that point, you enter into politics, because at that point, the distribution of food, when it acquires a black market value of this kind of price, then becomes hugely, hugely political. And this is where then the politics of the campaign, which is a campaign, after all, being waged by Israel for the destruction of Hamas and essentially, as far as we can see, the uprooting of the society in Gaza that supported Hamas, to say no more than that, right? That at this point, then, the question becomes, can you sustain this population if, as you're saying, all political order is being put in question? And it is true, of course, that feeding aid through political authorities on the ground, police authorities on the ground, that have for years now, since 2007 at least, been willy-nilly, whether they liked it or not, some of them may have liked it, some of them may not have, but necessarily collaborating with Hamas as the power in the Gaza Strip. If you are refusing to supply aid by way of them, then the question is, how on earth can you protect it and how on earth do you get it to the population? So at that point, the question of relief merges with the political question of reconstruction that is to come afterwards. And this is an experience which the aid agencies, before we move on to the question of reconstruction, have had again and again and again. And really, I think the test case of the difficulty of doing this is Somalia and Mogadishu, where for decades now, very large populations of displaced persons have had to be maintained by aid. And there's an entire, it's extraordinary, there is really an entire, not so much economics, but political economy of the relationship between aid agencies and what are called ISMs or gatekeepers or informal settlement managers. Because what emerges is that guys with guns and control over land and tents and places in which displaced people can live become, whether you like it or not, essential intermediaries between the aid agencies, which are bringing the essential supplies of water, the pipes that are necessary to do that, and the food, and the population that you're trying to relieve. And so you simply cannot escape this combined kind of political economy of relief. If you try and move around that and challenge the political structures which are forming, you have to have an alternative vision of what you're going to put in place, and you have to have the determination and the resources and the willingness to put aid workers in harm's way, or the willingness of aid workers to collaborate with soldiers who are going to have to impose themselves on informal structures of power which are shaping up in the crisis region. Otherwise, your only alternative essentially is to collaborate with these intermediaries. And experienced aid staff on the ground, when they look at Gaza, just immediately think, Mogadishu, how is this going to work? How are we going to keep a population of 2.5 million people alive unless we are going to have political and political economic relations with powers on the ground? Are we actually going to try and administer this whole region? And if you're not offering a vision for that, what is your vision of the destiny of these people? What hides behind your silence on this question? What actually do you intend if you don't intend to offer an answer to this question of how on earth do you get this food, this water down to a desperate population where people are willing to spend $1,000 for a 50-pound bag of flour?
Yeah, I mean, it's as if there's an implicit assumption of some kind of anarchic aid distribution system, but that doesn't exist.
It just doesn't work. It just leads to food rioting.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a kind of natural experiment in, you know, the kind of philosophical state of nature speculations.
That's all something extremely political.
Well.
it's an experiment in the destruction of an enemy state.
Yeah, then I guess to turn to the question that you alluded to, namely reconstruction. I mean, what would reconstruction look like against the background of this scale of destruction? I mean, in an optimistic scenario, say, I mean, like how long would reconstruction take? And what are then the prospects for those optimistic conditions even getting fulfilled?
Well, Gaza has been through destructive Israeli invasions before and has rebuilt. And in a previous episode, we discussed the tunnel economy, which was responsible for shipping in the supplies for the reconstruction. A key pillar of the Hamas political power was its control over that tunnel system. But we're talking about something far more comprehensive now in terms of destruction. So there really isn't a template for doing this. You pointed me, Cam, through some research you did to a bunch of reports done by UNCTAD and the World Bank earlier in the year. But if you dig into those, they have a sort of shadowy unreality to them at this point. Most of the estimates, in fairness to the analysts, were done earlier in the year before the full extent of the damage, I think, really began to sink in. They use estimates for Gaza's pre-crisis GDP. They adjust for Gaza's pre-crisis growth rate. They make adjustments along the level of previous Israeli incursions and the damage those did to Gaza GDP. And then you look at the pictures of Gaza now and you realize that the overwhelming majority of the population is displaced or harboring people who are displaced. And you simply ask yourselves, what on earth are you talking about? Like, what the image of an economy do you actually have in mind when you talk about reconstruction here? How is this going to be done? And what is the political frame? And this is the essential question. What is the political frame which is this going to be done in? And Israel, you know, at the end of February, they issued a one-page statement about its vision of Gaza's future the day after the, you know, what they envision as the final destruction of Hamas. And it at least provides a one-line pointer, which is to say that they expect Gaza to be administered by Palestinians with some experience of government. But they, of course, reject the possibility of a return of Hamas, which they want to destroy. They reject also, however, the possibility of the engagement of the Palestinian Authority, governed by Fatah from the West Bank, also not an option. They say they're going to rely on support from external powers that are agreeable to Israel to do this enormous job. But of course, the Arab states have all completely disowned this project unless Israel is willing to engage in serious conversations about a two-state solution. And in the background, it seems, and this is one of the really fascinating, grim things I didn't understand that I learned when reading about all of this, is that apparently there is a strain of Israeli thinking about Gaza's future and indeed Palestine's future, which denies Palestinian statehood in the sense that it in fact insists that Palestinian people belong in a kind of tribal culture. And the idea is that rather than a two-state, a two-nation solution, the future of Palestine consists in indirect rule, colonial style, in which Israel delegates the matter of authority to powerful clan and tribal groups, notably within Gaza. And between the 67 and 2005, this was apparently one of the strategies which Israel employed, was to maneuver its way around the PLO by working as closely as possible as it could with major clan structures. One of those included Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who ultimately goes on to become the founder of Hamas. And many people, of course, have argued for a long time that Hamas as an alternative to the PLO was a key element of Israeli power in the region. We're talking about families called Bakir and Dogmush, who are key clan groups in Gaza. And one of the nightmarish disasters that unfolded as recently as February 29th, apparently, was the so-called Flower Massacre, when the Israelis made a first attempt to ship several truckloads of flour into Gaza under the control of one of these clan groups. They found themselves overwhelmed by a hungry mob of Palestinians desperate to get their hand on the food. And either the clan militia or the Israelis opened fire, and well over 100 people were killed in the melee. And it was a complete fiasco of this effort to, as you described it, a kind of post-state, non-state solution to the question of distribution, relying on empowered local authorities and local agents to act. I don't think there is a vision here. And it's the absence of a vision, which in some senses, I think, is as terrifying as anything, because it implies a vision which ultimately means the erasure of Gaza as a functioning society that is in any sense a stepping stone, let alone the realization of Palestinian self-determination.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, what you're describing as a de facto plan sounds, to draw again back to the post-war German example, or the World War II German example, the Morgenthau plan, you know, where there was talk of sort of like de-developing Germany into a pastoral state. Obviously, that plan was scrapped, perhaps, in realization of how unrealistic that was. But yeah, certainly the reality right now is grim enough. Yeah, we'll leave the conversation here for now.
Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It's produced by Claudia Tatey, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Rob Sachs, and Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy readers. If you're interested in news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Listeners to Ones and Twos even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code Twos at checkout. That's T-O-O-Z-E. And listeners, as always, we love getting your feedback. You can leave voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com, or email us, podcast@foreignpolicy.com, or you can tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in your feed next week.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.